Chapter 1. Antecedents. The man was in Sopoture. So said, or rather breathed with his hard wheezing breath, Peter Smelly, shopkeeper and elder, into the ears of Robert Menzies, a brother elder, who was possessed of a more humane disposition. They were conversing in great confidence about the important case of Sergeant Adam Mercer. What that case was, the reader will learn by and by. The only reply of Robert Menzies was, "Is't possible?" accompanied by a start and a steady gaze at his well-informed brother. "It's a fact, I tell ye," continued Smelly, "but ye'll keep it to yoursel', keep it to yoursel', for it doesna do to injure a brither wi' cause, yet it's richt ye should ken what a bad beginning our Frayan has had. Pitch your thumb on't, however, in the underscore meantime underscore keep it, as the minister says, underscore in retinus underscore, which I suppose means, till needed." Smelly went on his way to attend to some parochial duty, nodding and smiling, and again admonishing his brother to keep it to himself. He seemed unwilling to part with the copyright of such a spicy bit of gossip. Menzies inwardly repeated, "A poacher? Wha would have thought it? At the same time, I see, but I will not record the harmonies, real or imaginary, which Mr. Menzies so clearly perceived between the early and latter habits of the sergeant." And yet the gossiping Smelly, whose nose had tracked out the history of many people in the parish of Drumsiley, was in this, as in most cases, accurately informed. The sergeant of whom he spoke had been a poacher some 30 years before, in a district several miles off. The wonder was how Smelly had discovered the fact, or how, if true, it could affect the present character or position of one of the best men in the parish. Yet true it was, and it is as well to confess it, not with a view of excusing it, but only to account for Mercer's having become a soldier, and to show how one who became meek as a sheathed sword in his later years, had once been possessed of a very keen and ardent temperament, whose ruling passion was the love of excitement, in the shape of battle with game and keepers. I accidentally heard the whole story, which, on account of other circumstances in the sergeant's later history, interested me more than I feared may my readers. Mercer did not care for money, nor seek to make a trade of the unlawful pleasure of shooting without a license. Nor in the district in which he lived was the offense then looked upon in a light so very disreputable as it is now, neither was it pursued by the same disreputable class. The sport itself was what Mercer loved for its own sake, and it had become to him quite a passion. For 2 or 3 years he had frequently transgressed, but he was at last caught on the early dawn of a summer's morning by John Spence, the gamekeeper of Lord Benwick. John had often received reports from the underkeeper and watchers, of some unknown and mysterious poacher who had hitherto eluded every attempt to seize him. Though rather too old for very active service, Spence resolved to concentrate all his experience for, like many a thoroughbred keeper, he had himself been a poacher in his youth to discover and secure the transgressor, but how he did so it would take pages to tell. Adam never suspected John of troubling himself about such details as that of watching poachers, and John never suspected that Adam was the poacher. The keeper, we may add, was cousin german to Mercer's mother. The capture itself was not difficult, for John, having lain in wait, suddenly confronted Adam, who, scorning the idea of flying, much more of struggling with his old cousin, quietly accosted him with, "Weel, John, ye ha' catched me at last." "Adam Mercer!" exclaimed the keeper, with a look of horror. "It canna be you. It's no possible." "It's just me, John, and no mistake," said Adam, quietly throwing himself down on the heather, and twisting a bit about his finger. "For better or more, I'm in your power, but had I been a ne'er-do-weel, like Willie Steele, or Tam Grath, I'd ha' blackened my face, and whammed ye o'er and pit your head in a wally afore ye could cheep as loud as a stained chucker, but when I saw why ye wore, I gied in. I wad rather than a 5-pun note I had never seen your face. Keep us. What's to be doin'? What will your mither say? And his lordship? Nah, what will onybody say why a spark of decency when they hear? Dinna fash your thoom, John, tack me and send me to the jail." "The jail? What good a will that do to you or me, laddie? I'm clean honored about the business. Let me sit down aside ye, keep lay, in case the keepers see ye, and tell me by what mischander ye ever took to this wicked business, and under my nose, as if underscore I underscore couldna fin ye oot." "Sport, sport," was Mercer's reply. "Ye can, John, I'm a shoemaker, and it's a dull trade, and squeezing the clams against the whey is ill for digestion, and when that fails, on spirits fail, and the world gets black and dowy. And when things gang rang why me, I canna flee to drink, but I think of the moors that I can't say weel when my faither was a keeper to Murray a Coltrane. Ye mind my faither? Was he no a honnet a gun?" "He was that the very best," said John. A wheel, continued Adam, when Dune in the mouth, I ponder o'er the broad days of health and life I had when carrying his bag, and getting a shot news and taunts as a reward, and it's a truth I tell ye, that the underscore work hickikik underscore a covia gruce I pits my blue oid in a tingle. It's a sort of madness that I can't account for, but I think I'm no responsible for it. Patricks are maist as bad, though turnips and stubble are no to be compared why the heather, nor walking among them like the far aff braes, the whiny taps of the hills, or the loun glens. Mony a time I hae promised to drap the gun and stick to the last, but when I'm no wheel, and walking and see the sun glinting, and think of the wide bleak muirs, and the fresh collar air of the hill, why the scent of the braes in the bog myrtle, and the whirring creatures man, I canna help it. I spring up and grasp the gun, and I'm aff. The reformed poacher and keeper listened with a poorly concealed smile, and said, nae doot, Adam, it's a natural I'm no denying that, it's a glorious business, in fact, it's just pair to every man that has a steady hand and a guidee and a feeling heart. Eh? Eh? But, Adam, were ye no frightened? For what? For the keepers. The keepers. Eh, John, that's half the sport. The thock to dodging keepers, jinking them rune hills, and dune glens, and lying among the muir hags, and nicking a bray sorjwa, and then fleeing like mad dune a bray and up an ither, and keeking here, and creeping there, and cowering along a fell dyke, and scudding through the wood that's mair than half the life out, John. I'm no sure if I could shoot the birds if they were a in my ain kale yard, and my ain property, and if I paid for them. But war ye no feared for me that kent ye? Asked John. Nah. Replied Adam, I was mair feared for your old cousin, my mither, gif she kent what I was aboot, for she's unco prue to you. But I didna think ye ever leweeked after poachers yoursel? No I hae telt ye aboot it. I faith, said John, taking a snuff and handing the box to Adam, it's human nature. But ye ken, human nature's wicked, desperately wicked. And afore I was a keeper my nature was fully as wicked as yours, fully, Adam, if no more. But I hae repented ever sin I was made keeper, and I wadna like to hinder your repentance. Nah, nah. We mauna be overprude. Say I'll, wait a bit, man, be canny till I see if ony of the lads are inzeeked, and John peeped over a knoll, and cautiously looked around in every direction until satisfied that he was alone. I'll no mention this job, he continued, if ye'll promise me, Adam, never to try this work again, for it's no respectable, and, versta, it's no safe, and ye wad get me into a habble as weel as yoursel. Say promise me, like a guide cousin, as I may see a ye, and blue it is thicker than water, ye can, and then just creep doon the burn, and along the plantain, and o'er the wa, till ye get until the peat road, and be aff like store afore the wind, but I canna why conscience let ye tack the birds why ye. Adam thought a little, and said, ye're a good soul, John, and I'll no betray ye. After a while he added, gravely, but I maun kill something. It's no in my heart as wickedness, but my fingers maun draw a trigger. After a pause, he continued, gie's your hand, John, ye hae been a freen to me, and I'll be a man of honour to you. I'll never poach mare, but I'll list and be a sodger. Till I send hae money, and I till no be a lang, be kind time I mither, and I'll never forget it. A sodger! Exclaimed John. But Adam, after seizing John by the hand and saying, farewell for a year and a day, suddenly started off down the glen, leaving two brace of grouse, with his gun, at John's feet, as much as to say, tell my lord how you caught the wicked poacher, and how he fled the country. Spence told indeed how he had caught a poacher, who had escaped, but never gave his name, nor ever hinted that Adam was the man. It was thus Adam Mercer poached and enlisted. One evening I was at the house of a magistrate with whom I was acquainted, when a man named Andrew Dick called to get my friend's signature to his pension paper, in the absence of the parish minister. Dick had been through the whole peninsular campaign, and had retired as a corporal. I am fond of old soldiers, and never fail when an opportunity offers to have a talk with them about the wars. On the evening in question, my friend Findlay, the magistrate, happened to say in a bluff kindly way, don't spend your pension in drink. Dick replied, saluting him, it's very hard, sir, that after fighting the battles of our country, we should be looked upon as worthless by gentlemen like you. No, no, Dick, I never said you were worthless, was the reply. Please your honor, said Dick. Ye did not say it, but I consider any man who spends his money in drink is worthless, and, what is mair, a fool, and, worse than all, is no Christian. He has no recovery in him, no supports to fall back on, but is in full retreat, as we would say, from common decency. But you know, said my friend, looking kindly on Dick, the bravest soldiers, and none were braver than those who served in the peninsula, often exceeded fearfully shamefully, and were a disgrace to humanity. Well, replied Dick, it's no easy to make evil good, and I won't try to do so, but yet ye forget our difficulties and temptations. Consider only, sir, that there we were, not in bed for months and months, marching at all hours, ill-fed, ill-clothed, and uncertain of life, which I assure your honor makes men indifferent to it, and we had often to get our mess as we best could, sometimes a tough steak out of a dead horse or mule, for when the beast was skinned it was difficult to make out its kind, and after toiling and moiling, up and down, here and there and everywhere, summer and winter, when at last we took a town with blood and wounds, and when a cask of wine or spirits fell in the way of the troops, I don't believe that you, sir, or the justices of the peace, or, with reverence be it spoken, the ministers themselves, would have said no, to a drop. You'll excuse me, sir, I'm perhaps too free with you. I didn't mean to lecture you, or to blame you, Dick, for I know the army is not the place for Christians. Begging your honor's pardon, sir, said Dick, the best Christians I ever knowed were in the army men who would do their duty to their king, their country, and their God. You have known such? I asked, breaking into the conversation, to turn it aside from what threatened to be a dispute. I have, sir. There's on Adam Mercer, in this very parish, an elder of the church I'm a dissenter misal, on principle, for I consider. Go on, Dick, about Mercer, never mind your church principles. Well, sir, as I was saying though, mind you, I'm not ashamed of being a dissenter, and, I hope, a Christian too. Adam was our sergeant, and a worthier man never shouldered a bayonet. He was nay great speaker, and was quiet as his gun when piled, but when he shot, he shot. That did he, short and pithy, a crack, and right into the argument. He was weel respected, for he was just and merciful, never bothered the men, and never picked out foes, but governed them, never preached, but could gie an advice in two or three words that gripped firm about the heart, and took the breath fray ye. He was extraordinaire brave. If there was any work to do by ordinaire, up to leading a forlorn hope, Adam was sure to be on't, and them that kenned him even better than I did then, said that he never got courage fray brandy, but, as they assured me, though ye'll maybe no believe it, his preparation was a prayer. I canna tell who they fan this oot, for Adam was unco quiet, but they say a drummer catched him on his knees afore he mounted the ladder why canch at the siege of Butahos, and that Adam telled him no to say a word about it, but yet to tack his advice and I to seek God's help mair than man's. This narrative interested me much, so that I remembered its facts, and connected them with what I afterwards heard about Adam Mercer many years ago, when on a visit to Drumsiley. Chapter 2. The Elder and His Starling. When Adam Mercer returned from the wars, more than half a century ago, he settled in the village of Drumsiley, situated in a county bordering on the highlands, and about 20 miles from the scene of his poaching habits, of which he had long ago repented. His hot young blood had been cooled down by hard service, and his vehement temperament subdued by military discipline, but there remained an admirable mixture in him of deepest feeling, regulated by habitual self-restraint, and expressed in a manner outwardly calm but not cold, undemonstrative but not unkind. His whole bearing was that of a man accustomed at once to command and to obey. Corporal Dick had not formed a wrong estimate of his Christianity. The lessons taught by his mother, whom he fondly loved, and whom he had in her widowhood supported to the utmost of his means from pay and prize money, and her example of a simple, cheerful, and true life, had sunk deeper than he knew into his heart, and, taking root, had sprung up amidst the stormy scenes of war, bringing forth the fruits of stern self-denial and moral courage tempered by strong social affections. Adam had resumed his old trade of shoemaker. He occupied a small cottage, which, with the aid of a poor old woman in the neighborhood, who for an hour morning and evening did the work of a servant, he kept with singular neatness. His little parlor was ornamented with several memorials of the war, a sword or two picked up on memorable battlefields, a French cuirass from Waterloo, with a gaudy print of Wellington, and one also of the meeting with Blucher at La Belle Alliance. The sergeant attended the parish church as regularly as he used to do parade. Anyone could have set his watch by the regularity of his movements on Sunday mornings. At the same minute on each succeeding day of holy rest and worship, the tall, erect figure, with well-braced shoulders, might be seen stepping out of the cottage door, where he stood erect for a moment to survey the weather, dressed in the same suit of black trousers, brown surtout, buff waistcoat, black stock, white cotton gloves, with a yellow cane under his arm, everything so neat and clean, from the polished boots to the polished hat, from the well-brushed gray whiskers to the well-arranged locks that met in a peak over his high forehead and soldier-like face. And once within the church there was no more sedate or attentive listener. There were few weekdays and no Sunday evenings on which the sergeant did not pay a visit to some neighbor confined to bed from sickness, or suffering from distress of some kind. He manifested rare tact made up of common sense and genuine benevolence on such occasions. His strong sympathies put him instantly underscore en rapport underscore with those whom he visited, enabling him at once to meet them on some common ground. Yet in whatever way the sergeant began his intercourse, whether by listening patiently, and what a comfort such listening silence is, to the history of the sickness or the sorrow which had induced him to enter the house, or by telling some of his own adventures, or by reading aloud the newspaper, he in the end managed with perfect naturalness to convey truths of weightiest import, and fraught with enduring good and comfort, all backed up by a humanity, an unselfishness, and a gentlemanlike respect for others, which made him a most welcome guest. The humble were made glad, and the proud were subdued, they knew not how, nor probably did the sergeant himself, for he but fell to ride and acted as he felt, rather than endeavor to devise a plan as to underscore how underscore he should speak or act in order to produce a definite result. He numbered many true friends, but it was not possible for him to avoid being secretly disliked by those with whom, from their character, he would not associate, or whom he tacitly rebuked by his own orderly life and good manners. Two events, in no way connected, but both of some consequence to the sergeant, turned the current of his life after he had resided a few years in Drumsiley. One was, that by the unanimous choice of the congregation, to whom the power was committed by the minister in his Kirk session, Mercer was elected to the office of elder in the parish. This was a most unexpected compliment, and one which the sergeant for a time declined. Indeed, he accepted it only after many arguments addressed to his sense of duty, and enforced by pressing personal reasons brought to bear on his kind heart by his minister, Mr. Porteous. The other event, of equal, may we not safely say of greater importance to him? Was his marriage. We need not tell the reader how this came about, or unfold all the subtle magic ways by which a woman worthy to be loved loosed the cords that had hitherto tied up the sergeant's heart, or how she tapped the deep well of his affections into which the purest drops had for years been falling, until it gushed out with a freshness, fullness, and strength, which are, perhaps, oftenest to be found in an old heart, when it is touched by one whom it dares to love, as that old heart of Adam Mercer's must do if it loved at all. Katie Mitchell was out of her teens when Adam, in a happy moment of his life, met her in the house of her widowed mother, who had been confined to a bed of feebleness and pain for years, and whom she had tended with a patience, cheerfulness, and unwearied goodness which makes many a humble and unknown home a very Eden of beauty and peace. Her father had been a leading member of a very strict Presbyterian body, called the Old Light, in which he shone with a brightness which no church on earth could of itself either kindle or extinguish, and which, when it passed out of the earthly dwelling, left a subdued glory behind it which never passed away. Faither was always an authority with Katie and her mother, his ways a constant teaching, and his words were to them as echoes from the Rock of Ages. The marriage took place after the death of Kate's mother, and soon after Adam had been ordained to the eldership. A boy was born to the worthy couple, and named Charles, after the sergeant's father. It was a sight to banish bachelorship from the world, to watch the joy of the sergeant with Charlie from the day he experienced the new and indescribable feelings of being a father, until the flaxen-haired blue-eyed boy was able to underscore toddle underscore to his waiting arms, and then be mounted on his shoulders, while he stepped round the room to the tune of the old familiar regimental march, performed by him with half-whistle half-trumpet tones, which vainly expressed the roll of the band that crashed harmoniously in memory's ear. Katie didn't let on her motherly pride and delight at the spectacle, which never became stale or commonplace. Adam had a weakness for pets. Dare we call such tastes a weakness, and not rather a minor part of his religion, which included within its wide embrace a love of domestic animals, in which he saw, in their willing dependence on himself, a reflection of more than they could know, or himself even fully understand. At the time we write, a starling was his special friend. It had been caught and tamed for his boy Charlie. Adam had taught the creature with greatest care to speak with precision. Its first and most important lesson was, "I'm Charlie's bairn." And one can picture the delight with which the child heard this innocent confession, as the bird put his head askance, looked at him with his round full eye, and in clear accents acknowledged his parentage, "I'm Charlie's bairn." The boy fully appreciated his feathered confidant, and soon began to look upon him as essential to his daily enjoyment. The sergeant had also taught the starling to repeat the words, "A man's a man for a' that," and to whistle a bar or two of the ditty, "Wall be king but Charlie." Katie had more than once confessed that she was now unco fond of this kind of diversion. She pronounced it to be neither natural nor canny, and had often remonstrated with the sergeant for what she called his idol, foolish, and even profane painstaking in teaching the bird. But one night, when the sergeant announced that the education of the starling was complete, she became more vehement than usual on this assumed perversion of the will of Providence. "Nothing," said the sergeant, "can be more beautiful than is a man's a man for a that." "The mare's the pity, Adam," said Katie. "It's rank clean rang I tell ye, and ye'll live te rue it. What right his underscore he underscore to speak? Cock him up why his impudence. There's mony a bairn older than him canna speak say weel. It's no a safe business, I can tell you, Adam."
Gee ower, woman," said the sergeant, "the creature has its same gifts, as we hae yours, and I'm thankful for them. It is me mair good than ye can why an attack the boy on my lap, and see who is he blinks, and his bit feet gang, and who he laughs when he hears the bird say, I'm Charlie's bairn. And when I'm cutting, and stitching, and hammering, at the window, and dreaming auld lang syne, and feetin' my battles o'er again, and when I think of that awful time that I hae seen why brave comrades no lying in some nuke in Spain, and when I hear the roar of the big guns, and the spluttering crackle of the wee anes, and see the crew to red coats, and the flashing of bagnets, and the awful hell excuse me of the fact, I tell you it's like a sermon to me when the creature says a man's a man for a that." The sergeant would say this, standing up, and erect, with one foot forward as if at the first step of the scaling ladder. "Mind ye, Katie, that it's no every man that's a man for a that, but mair than ye wad believe are a set of fushionless, water gruel, useless clutes, called sins, when it comes to the real bit the grip between life and death. Oh ye wad wonder, woman, whom ony men when on parade, or when singing songs about the war, are grand hands, but while I flat a scones on the grass when they see the cold iron. Gee me the man that does his duty, whether he meets man or devil that's the man for me in war or peace, and that's the reason I teach the bird de words. It's a testimony for auld friends that I focht why, and that I'll never forget no, never. Dinna be sire, you'd wife, on the pure bird. Eh, Katie," he added, one night, when the bird had retired to roost, "just look at the creature. Isna he beautiful? There he sits on his bock as roon as a clue, why his bit head under his wing, dreamin' aboot the woods maybe or aboot wee Charlie or Ablin's aboot anything. But he is God's ain bird, wonderful and fearfully made." Still Katie, feeling that a principle as she, underscore a la mode underscore, called her opinion was involved in the bird's linguistic habits, would still maintain her cause with the same arguments, put in a variety of forms. Nah, Adam," she would persistingly affirm, "I underscore will underscore say that for a sensible man and an elder of the kirk, ye're o'er muckle tine up why that creature. I'll stick tot, that it's no fair, no richt, but a mockery a man. I'm sure faith or wadna hay pittin' up wit. Dinna be flighting on the wee thing why it's speckled breast and bonny e. Charlie's bairn, ye can mind that. I'm no flighting on him, for it's you, know him, that's rang. Mony a time when I spack to you misel, ye were as deaf as a doornail to underscore me underscore, and can hear anything in the house but that we neba his feeding awa Wyatt's lesson. Nah, ye needna glower at me, and look say astonished, for I'm perfect serious. Ye're speaking perfect nonsense, ye'd wife, let me assure you, and I underscore am underscore astonished at ye," replied Adam, resuming his work on the bench. "I'm no sick a thing, Adam, as spake a nonsense," retorted his wife, sitting down with her seam beside him. "I can mair aboot they jabbering birds maybe than yoursel. For I'll never forget an awful job why on of them that made a stirmash atween Mr. Carruthers, our all licked minister, and Willie J. Misson the customer weaver. The minister happened to be visiting in Willie's house, and exhorting him and some neighbors that had gathered to hear. Weel, what hay ye out, but onity parrots, or kick cuckoo birds or whatever ye see a them had been broke tame by Willie's brother's son him that was in the Indies and didna this creature cry oot stap your blethers. Just to hint the minister, waggied sickle oop, and thought it a cunning device of Satan. Ye'd wife, struck in the sergeant, as he turned to her with a laugh, "O dinna blether yoursel, for ye never did it afore. They micked hay hung the bird cage oot while the minister was in. But what had the pure bird to do why Satan or religion? Wees me for the religion that could be hurt by a bird's cracks. The creature didna ken what it was saying." "Didna ken what it was saying!" exclaimed Katie, with evident amazement. "I tell ye, I've seen it mony a time. And heard it, too, and it was a handle sensibler than maist bairns 10 times its size. I was watching it that day when it disturbed Mr. Carruthers, and I seed it lookin' roon, and winkin' its ane, and scartin' its head lang afore its back, and it tried its tongue and black it was, as ye micht expect, and dry as ben leather 3 or 4 times afore it got a sooned out, And though the foreign unit had never spake a word, yet when the minister began, its tongue was loused, and it yoked on them why its scalp sang, "Stap your blethers, stap your blethers." It was mace tofu te heart. I mount aloo, hoover, that it cam frae a heathen land, and wasna therefore say muckle to be blamed. But I couldna mock the same excuse for underscore your underscore bird, Adam. A loud laugh from Adam proved at once to Katie that she had neither offended nor convinced him by her arguments. But all real or imaginary differences between the sergeant and his wife about the starling, ended with the death of their boy. What that was to them both, parents only who have lost a child and only child can tell. It cut up, as they say, the sergeant terribly. Katie seemed suddenly to become old. She kept all her boys' clothes in a press, and it was her wont for a time to open it as if for worship, every night, and to get her greed out. The sergeant never looked into it. Once, when his wife awoke at night and found him weeping bitterly, he told his first and only fib, for he said that he had an excruciating headache. A headache. He would no more have wept for a headache of his own than he would for one endured by his old foe, Napoleon. This great bereavement made the starling a painful but almost a holy remembrancer of the child. "I'm Charlie's bairn," was a death knell in the house. When repeated, no comment was made. It was generally heard in silence, but one day, Adam and his wife were sitting at the fireside taking their meal in a sad mood, and the starling, perhaps under the influence of hunger, or who knows, from an uneasy instinctive sense of the absence of the child, began to repeat rapidly the sentence, "I'm Charlie's bairn." The sergeant rose and went to its cage with some food, and said, with as much earnestness as if the bird had understood him, "You're just underscore is underscore bairn, and ye'll be underscore my underscore bairn tae as lang as ye live." "A man's a man for a' that," quoth the bird. "Sometimes no," murmured the sergeant. Chapter 3. The Starling, a Disturber of the Peace. It was a beautiful Sunday morning in spring. The dew was glittering on every blade of grass, the trees were bursting into buds for coming leaves, or into flower for coming fruit, the birds were busy in the wood building their nests, and singing jubilate, the streams were flashing to the sea, the clouds, moisture-laden, were moving across the blue heavens, guided by the winds, and signs of life, activity, and joy filled the earth and sky. The sergeant hung out Charlie in his cage to enjoy the air and sunlight. He had not of late been so lively as usual, his confession as to his parentage was more hesitating, and when giving his testimony as to a man being a man, or as to the exclusive right of Charlie to be king, he often paused as if in doubt. All his utterances were accompanied by a spasmodic chirp and jerk, evidencing a great indifference to humanity. A glimpse of nature might possibly recover him. And so it did, for he had not been long outside before he began to spread his wings and tail feathers to the warm sun, and to pour out more confessions and testimonies than had been heard for weeks. Charlie soon gathered round him a crowd of young children with rosy faces and tattered garments who had clattered down from lanes and garrets to listen to his performances. Every face in the group became a picture of wonder and delight, as intelligible sounds were heard coming from a hard bill, and any one of the crowd would have sold all he had on earth, not a great sacrifice after all, perhaps a penny, to possess such a bird. "Do you hear it, Archie?" a boy would say, lifting up his little brother on his shoulder, to be near the cage. Another would repeat the words uttered by the distinguished speaker, and direct attention to them. Then, when all were hushed into silent and eager expectancy awaiting the next oracular statement, and the starling repeated "I'm Charlie's bairn," and whistled while became but Charlie, a shout of joyous merriment followed, with sundry imitations of the bird's peculiar guttural and rather rude pronunciation. "It's a witch, I'll wager," one boy exclaimed. "Dinna say that," replied another, "for wee Charlie's dead." Yet it would be difficult to trace any logical contradiction between the supposed and the real fact. This audience about the cage was disturbed by the sudden and unexpected appearance from round the corner, of a rather portly man, dressed in black clothes, his head erect, his face intensely grave, an umbrella, handle foremost, under his right arm, his left arm swinging like a pendulum, a pair of black spats covering broad flat feet, that advanced with the regular beat of slow music, and seemed to impress the pavement with their weight. This was the Reverend Daniel Porteous, the parish minister. No sooner did he see the crowd of children at the elder's door than he paused for a moment, as if he had unexpectedly come across the execution of a criminal, and no sooner did the children see him, than with a terrified shout of "There's the minister!" they ran off as if they had seen a wild beast, leaving one or two of the younger ones sprawling and bawling on the road, their natural protectors being far too intent on saving their own lives, to think of those of their nearest relatives. The sudden dispersion of these lambs by the shepherd soon attracted the attention of their parents, and accordingly several half-clad, Slatternly women rushed from their respective closes. Flying to the rescue of their children, they carried some and dragged others to their several corners within the dark caves. But while rescuing their wicked cubs, they religiously beat them, and manifested their zeal by many stripes and not a few admonitions, tack that and that and that ye bad bad wicked ween. Who dower ye? I'll gee ye your pay. I'll mock ye. Eyes warrant ye. And see. And see. These were some of the motherly teachings to the terrified babes, while cries of Archie, Peter, Jamie, with threatening shakes of the fist, and commands to come home immediately, were addressed to the elder ones, who had run off to a safe distance. One tall woman, whose brown hair escaped from beneath a cap black enough to give one the impression that she had been humbling herself in sackcloth and ashes, proved the strength of her convictions by complaining very vehemently to Mr. Porteous of the sergeant for having thrown such a temptation as the starling in the way of her children, whom she loved so tenderly and wished to bring up so piously. All the time she held a child firmly by the hand, who attempted to hide its face and tears from the minister. Her zeal we must assume was very real, since her boy had clattered off from the cage on shoes made by the sergeant, which his mother had never paid for, nor was likely to do now, for conscience sake, on account of this bad conduct of the shoemaker. We do not affirm that Mrs. Dalrymple never _liquidated_ her debts, but she did so after her own fashion. It was edifying to hear other mothers declare their belief that their children had been at the morning Sabbath school, and express their wonder and anger at discovering for the first time their absence from it, more especially as this the only day, of course, on which it had occurred should be the day that the minister accidentally passed to church along their street. The minister listened to the story of their good intentions, and of the ill doings of his elder with an uneasy look, but promised speedy redress. Chapter 4. The Rev. Daniel Porteous. Mr. Porteous had been minister of the parish for upwards of 30 years. Previously he had been tutor in the family of a small laird who had political interest in those old times, and through whose influence with the patron of the parish he had obtained the living of Drumsiley. He was a man of unimpeachable character. No one could charge him with any act throughout his whole life inconsistent with the walk and conversation becoming his profession. He performed all the duties of his office with the regularity of a well-adjusted, well-oiled machine. He visited the sick, and spoke the right words to the afflicted, the widow, and the orphan, very much in the same calm, regular, and orderly manner in which he addressed the presbytery or wrote out a minute of Kirk session. Never did a man possess a larger or better assorted collection of what he called principles in the carefully locked cabinet of his brain, applicable at any moment to any given ecclesiastical or theological question which was likely to come before him. He made no distinction between principles and his own mere opinions. The _Dixit_of truth and the _Dixit_of Porteous were looked upon by him as one. He had never been accused of error on any point, however trivial, except on one occasion when, in the presbytery, a learned clerk of great authority interrupted a speech of his by suggesting that their respected friend was speaking heresy. Mr. Porteous exclaimed, to the satisfaction of all, "I was not aware of it, moderator. But if such is the opinion of the presbytery, I have no hesitation in instantly withdrawing my unfortunate and unintentional assertion." His mind ever after was a round, compact ball of logically spun theological worsted, wound up, and made up. The glacier, clear, cold, and stern, descends into the valley full of human habitations, cornfields, and vineyards, with flowers and fruit trees on every side, and though its surface melts occasionally, it remains the glacier still. So it had hitherto been with him. He preached the truth which is the world's life and which stirs the angels but too often as a telegraphic wire transmits the most momentous intelligence, and he grasped it as a sparrow grasps the wire by which the message is conveyed. The parish looked up to him, obeyed him, feared him, and so respected him that they were hardly conscious of not quite loving him. Nor was he conscious of this blank in their feelings, for feelings and tender affections were in his estimation generally dangerous and always weak commodities, a species of womanly sentimentalism, and apt sometimes to be rebellious against his principles, as the stream will sometimes overflow the rocky sides that hem it in and direct its course. It would be wrong to deny that he possessed his own fair humanities. He had friends who sympathized with him, and followers who thankfully accepted him as a safe light to guide them, as one stronger than themselves to lean on, and as one whose word was law to them. To all such he could be bland and courteous, and in their society he would even relax, and indulge in such anecdotes and laughter as bordered on genuine hilarity. As to what was deepest and truest in the man we know not, but we believe there was real good beneath the wood, hay, and stubble of formalism and pedantry. There was doubtless a kernel within the hard shell, if only the shell could be cracked. Might not this be done? We shall see. It was this worthy man who, after visiting a sick parishioner, suddenly came round the corner of the street in which the sergeant lived. He was, as we said, on his way to church, and the bell had not yet begun to ring for morning worship. Before entering the sergeant's house, to do which, after the scene he had witnessed, was recognized by him to be an important duty, he went up to the cage to make himself acquainted with all the facts of the case, so as to proceed with it regularly. He accordingly put on his spectacles and looked at the bird, and the bird, without any spectacles, returned the inquiring gaze with most wonderful composure. Walking sideways along his perch, until near the minister, he peered at him full in the face, and confessed that he was Charlie's Baron. Then, after a preliminary underscore kick underscore and underscore cur underscore, as if clearing his throat, he whistled two bars of the air, "Well, I'll be king but Charlie." And, concluding with his aphorism, "A man's a man for a' that," he whetted his beak and retired to feed in the presence of the church dignitary. "I could not have believed it," exclaimed the minister, as he walked into the sergeant's house, with a countenance by no means indicating the sway of amiable feelings. Chapter 5. The Sergeant and His Starling in Trouble. The sergeant and his wife, after having joined, as was their wont, in private morning worship, had retired, to prepare for church, to their bedroom in the back part of the cottage, and the door was shut. Not until a loud knock was twice repeated on the kitchen table, did the sergeant emerge in his shirt sleeves to reply to the summons. His surprise was great as he exclaimed, "Mr. Porteous! Can it be you? Beg pardon, sir, if I have kept you waiting, please be seated. No bad news, I hope?" Mr. Porteous, with a cold nod, and remaining where he stood, pointed with his umbrella to the cage hanging outside the window, and asked the sergeant if that was his bird. "It is, sir," replied the sergeant, more puzzled than ever. "It is a favorite starling of mine, and I hung it out this morning to enjoy the air, because—" "You need not proceed, Mr. Mercer," interrupted the minister. "It is enough for me to know from yourself that you acknowledge that bird as yours, and that underscore you underscore hung it there." "There is no doubt about that, sir, and what then?" "I really am puzzled to know why you ask," said the sergeant. "I won't leave you long in doubt upon that point," continued the minister, more stern and calm if possible than before, "nor on some others which it involves." Kitty, at this crisis of the conversation, joined them in her black silk gown. She entered the kitchen with a familiar smile and respectful curtsy, and approached the minister, who, barely noticing her, resumed his subject. Kitty, somewhat bewildered, sat down in a large chair beside the fire, watching the scene with curious perplexity. "Are you aware, Mr. Mercer, of what has just happened?" inquired the minister. "I do not take you up, sir," replied the sergeant. "Well, then, as I approached your house a crowd of children were gathered round that cage, laughing and singing, with evident enjoyment, and disturbing the neighborhood by their riotous proceedings, thus giving pain and grief to their parents, who have complained loudly to me of the injury done to their most sacred feelings and associations by underscore you underscore please, please, don't interrupt me, Mr. Mercer, I have a duty to perform, and shall finish presently." The sergeant bowed, folded his arms, and stood erect. Katie covered her face with her hands, and exclaimed, "Tuts, tuts, I'm real sorry, tuts." "I went up to the cage," said Mr. Porteous, continuing his narrative, "and narrowly inspected the bird. To my what shall I call it? Astonishment? Or shame and confusion? I heard it utter such distinct and articulate sounds as convinced me beyond all possibility of doubt, yet you smile, sir, at my statement. That—" "Tuts, Adam, it's dreadful!" ejaculated Katie. "That the bird," continued the minister, "underscore must underscore have been either taught by you, or with your approval, and having so instructed this creature, you hang it out on this, the Sabbath morning, to whistle and to speak, in order to insult—" "Yes, sir, I use the word advisedly." "Never, sir," said the sergeant, with a calm and firm voice, "never, sir, did I intentionally insult mortal man. I have nothing to do with your intentions, but with underscore facts underscore, and the fact is, you did insult, sir, every feeling the most sacred, besides injuring the religious habits of the young. Underscore you underscore did this, an elder underscore my underscore elder, this day, to the great scandal of religion." The sergeant never moved, but stood before his minister as he would have done before his general, calm, in the habit of respectful obedience to those having authority. Poor Katie acted as a sort of underscore chorus underscore at the fireside. "I never thought it would come to this," she exclaimed, twisting her fingers. "Oh! It's a pity. Sir's a day. Vas me. Sick a day as I have lived to see. Speak, Adam. at length she said, as if to relieve her misery. The silence of Adam so far helped the minister as to give him time to breathe, and to think. He believed that he had made an impression on the sergeant, and that it was possible things might not be so bad as they had looked. He hoped and wished to put them right, and desired to avoid any serious quarrel with Mercer, whom he really respected as one of his best elders, and as one who had never given him any trouble or uneasiness, far less opposition. Adam, on the other hand, had been so suddenly and unexpectedly attacked, that he hardly knew for a moment what to say or do. Once or twice the old ardent temperament made him feel something at his throat, such as used to be there when the order to charge was given, or the command to form square and prepare to receive cavalry. But the habits of drill and the power of passive endurance came to his aid, along with a higher principle. He remained silent. When the steam had roared off, and the ecclesiastical boiler of Mr. Porteous was relieved from extreme pressure, he began to simmer, and to be more quiet about the safety valve. Sitting down, and so giving evidence of his being at once fatigued and mollified, he resumed his discourse. Sergeant, he had hitherto addressed him as Mr. Mercer Sergeant, you know my respect for you. I will say that a better man, a more attentive hearer, a more decided and consistent churchman, and a more faithful elder, I have not in my parish. Adam bowed. Be also seated, said the minister. Thank you, sir, said Adam, I would rather stand. I will after all give you credit for not intending to do this evil which I complain of. I withdraw the appearance even of making any such charge, said Mr. Porteous, as if asking a question. After a brief silence, the sergeant said, you have given me great pain, Mr. Porteous. How so, Adam? Still more softened. It is great pain, sir, to have one's character doubted, said Adam. But have I not cause? Inquired the minister. You are of course the best judge, Mr. Porteous, but I frankly own to you that the possibility of there being any harm in teaching a bird never occurred to me. Oh, Adam! Exclaimed Kitty, I ken it was I underscore your underscore mine that, but it wasna mine, although at last. Let me alone, Kitty, just now, quietly remarked Adam. What of the scandal? What of the scandal? Struck in the minister. I have no time to discuss details this morning, the bells have commenced. Well, then, said the sergeant, I was not aware of the disturbance in the street which you have described. I never, certainly, could have intended underscore that underscore. I was, at the time, in the bedroom, and never knew of it. Believe me when I say it, that no man lives who would feel more pain than I would in being the occasion of ever leading anyone to break the Lord's day by word or deed, more especially the young, and the young about our doors are among the verst. And as to my showing disrespect to you, sir, that never could be my intention. I believe you, Adam, I believe you, but... Eh, weel ye may, chimed in Katie, now weeping as she saw some hope of peace, for he's off who tied up why guide, is Adam, though I say it. Oh, Katie, dinna, woman, fash yoursel why me, interpolated Adam. Though I sate that shouldna sate, continued Katie, I'm sure he has the greatest respect for you, sir. He'll do anything to please you that's possible, and to mock amends for this great misfortune. Of that I have no doubt, no doubt whatever, Mrs. Mercer, said Mr. Porteous, kindly, and I wished, in order that he should do so, to be faithful to him, as he well knows I never will sacrifice my principles to any man, be he who he may never. There is no difficulty, I am happy to say, the minister resumed, after a moment's pause, in settling the whole of this most unpleasant business. Indeed I promised to the neighbors, who were very naturally offended, that it should never occur again, and as you acted, Adam, from ignorance and we must not blame an old soldier underscore too underscore much, the minister added with a patronizing smile, all parties will be satisfied by a very small sacrifice indeed almost too small, considering the scandal. Just let the bird be forthwith destroyed that is all. Adam started. In any case, the minister went on to say, without noticing the sergeant's look, this should be done, because being an elder, and, as such, a man with grave and solemn responsibilities, you will I am sure see the propriety of at once acquiescing in my proposal, so as to avoid the temptation of your being occupied by trifles and frivolities contemptible trifles, not to give a harsher name to all that the bird's habits indicate. But when, in addition to this consideration, these habits, Adam, have, as a fact, occasioned serious scandal, no doubt can remain in any well-constituted mind as to the underscore necessity underscore of the course I have suggested. Destroy Charlie I mean, the starling? Inquired the sergeant, stroking his chin, and looking down at the minister with a smile in which there was more of sorrow and doubt than of any other emotion. "Do you mean, Mr. Porteous, that I should kill him?"
"I don't mean that, necessarily, underscore you underscore should do it, though underscore you underscore ought to do it as the offender. But I certainly mean that it should be destroyed in any way, or by any person you please, as, if not the best possible, yet the easiest amends which can be made for what has caused such injury to morals and religion, and for what has annoyed myself more than I can tell. Remember, also, that the credit of the eldership is involved with my own."
"Are you serious, Mr. Porteous?" asked the sergeant.
"Serious. Serious. Your minister? On Sabbath morning. In a grave matter of this kind. To ask if I am serious. Mr. Mercer, you are forgetting yourself."
"I ask pardon," replied the sergeant, "if I have said anything disrespectful, but I really did not take in how the killing of my pet starling could mend matters, for which I say again, that I am really vexed, and ask your pardon. What has happened has been quite unintentional on my part, I do assure you, sir."
"The death of the bird," said the minister, "I admit, in one sense, is a mere trifle, a trifle to underscore you underscore, but it is not so to underscore me underscore, who am the guardian of religion in the parish, and as such have pledged my word to your neighbors that this, which I have called a great scandal, shall never happen again. The least that you can do, therefore, I humbly think, as a proof of your regret at having been even the innocent cause of acknowledged evil, as a satisfaction to your neighbors, and a security against a like evil occurring again, and as that which is due to yourself as an office bearer, to the parish, and, I must add, to underscore me underscore as your pastor, and underscore my underscore sense of what is right, and, finally, in order to avoid a triumph to dissent on the one hand, and to infidelity on the other, it is, I say, beyond all question your clear duty to remove the underscore cause underscore of the offense, by your destroying that paltry insignificant bird. I must say, Mr. Mercer, that I feel not a little surprised that your own sense of what is right does not compel you at once to acquiesce in my very moderate demand, so moderate, indeed, that I am almost ashamed to make it."
No response from the sergeant. "Many men, let me tell you," continued Mr. Porteous, "would have summoned you to the Kirk session, and rebuked you for your whole conduct, actual and implied, in this case, and, if you had been contumacious, would then have libeled and deposed you." The minister was warming as he proceeded. "I have no time," he added, rising, "to say more on this painful matter. But I ask you now, after all I have stated, and before we part, to promise me this favor." "No, I won't put it on the ground of a personal favor, but on underscore principle underscore promise me to do this, not today, of course, but on a weekday, say tomorrow, to destroy the bird, and I shall say no more about it. Excuse my warmth, Adam, as I may be doing you the injustice of assuming that you do not see the gravity of your own position or of mine." And Mr. Porteous stretched out his hand to the sergeant.
"I have no doubt, sir," said the sergeant, calmly, "that you mean to do what seems to you to be right, and what you believe to be your duty. But," and there was a pause, "but I will not deceive you, nor promise to do what I feel I can never perform. Underscore I underscore must also do underscore my underscore duty, and I dorn to do what seems to me to be wrang, cruel, and unnecessary. I cannot kill the bird. It is simply impossible. Do pardon me, sir. Do not think me disrespectful or prude. At this moment I am neither, but very vexed to have had any disturbance why my minister. Yet.
Yet what, Mr.